It was dark. It was very, very dark. To see your own hand in front of your face would have been impossible. No light at all penetrated the darkness. Then the lights came on. We were standing, holding on to a railing in the depths of Carlsbad Caverns, New Mexico. We had reached one of the deepest, innermost rooms of those caverns, said to be one of the darkest places on earth. It did not take more than just a few seconds to begin to wonder what would happen if the lights failed to come back on. You get a little nervous at times like that. And while there is surely no comparison in anything more than the human sensory sense, it gave me the slightest connection with what the earth must have been like before God intervened to restore it. In fact, when I began to talk about the darkness, some few of you may have actually suspected I was talking about that very scene. Because we try to imagine how such things are, how they can be, and in most cases we simply can't get close to the reality any more than we can get close to the reality of seeing the glory of God. But let's go back and review that incident for a few moments in Genesis chapter 1. Genesis 1, verse 1. We read this part before. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Verse 2 says, the earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. That's a pretty brief statement of the conditions, and you have to actually go through much of the rest of the description of this recreative process to understand maybe a little more of what the actual conditions were like. But for the most part, that's it. Darkness was on the face of the deep. That added to the statement that it was tohu and bohu, or waste and empty, or in chaos and confusion, or any number of ways you might interpret that, tells you that things weren't good. Everything was dark. Darkness was on the face of the deep. And then in verse 3, God said, let there be light. And there was light. And again, a very brief summary statement, though that's all we need in this case, because God says when he says it, it's done. He speaks the word and it happens. And so when God said, let there be light, the very force of his power in the words themselves apparently caused that to happen. Let there be light. And so the lights came on in that sense all over the earth, perhaps all over this part of the universe, the entire solar system, as we later see that God then used that light to determine day and night and times and seasons and years and so forth. So the darkness was there, and then the light occurred. And then we go on to see, and I won't read this, but the rest of the process as God set the planets, the solar system in place, divided the water that is in the heavens from the waters on the earth, etc. God began to create and develop a habitat that was convenient and appropriate into which to create and place mankind made in his own image, which we read later in this chapter and others. God made man in his own image, and God had a great and wonderful purpose for that. But this discussion here is often sort of overlooked in the simple memory processes of saying, oh, we know that in the beginning God made the heavens and the earth. And we do know that. What we might not know, and we will discuss at some future time in more detail, is that God uses that terminology to describe himself and his creative power on many occasions in the scriptures. Let's go to Nehemiah chapter 9. In Nehemiah chapter 9, there is an interesting reference to God's power and God's creativity in this context. Here the Levites are standing to bless Israel. And we read in the latter part of verse 5, in my Bible it's set apart as poetry or a quote, "Stand up and bless the Eternal your God forever and ever. Blessed be your glorious name, which is exalted above all blessing and praise." Verse 6, "You alone are the Eternal." That's important. You alone are the Eternal. You have made heaven, the heaven of heavens, with all their host, the earth and everything on it, the seas and all that is in them, and you preserve them all. The host of heaven worships you. Goes on to define further, "You are the Eternal God who chose Abram, who brought him out of Ur of the Chaldeans and gave him the name Abraham." And of course, we know that a great deal of history and our understanding of who we are and why we're here flows from that act and from that statement. God is the God who created the heavens, the earth, and this goes on to add, the sea, and all that is in all three of those, the heavens, the earth, and the sea. And we think we can comprehend that, but do you know, in spite of the, I can't even remember the numbers now, so I won't try to guess, but the tens of thousands of creatures, let alone the plants, both in the heavens and in the earth and in the sea, in spite of all of those numbers, we are still discovering unknown animals and unknown plants. There were several species discovered just in the past year, 6,000 years after the events that we were just reading about. And so God made the heavens, the earth, the sea, and all that's in them. And it's easy to take all of that for granted or to forget about it when we start thinking about praying or relating to God or remembering God's power to intervene in our personal lives. We must not ever take that power and that action for granted, because it is the foundation of everything we know about God and what God is doing in our lives today and why he's doing it. In Isaiah chapter 45, in the prophecies of Isaiah, God inspires him to give us some further information about him and his role. And we have talked about in the past two sermons who God is, what God is doing, how great God is, how wonderful God is. And we could go on for sermon after sermon after sermon. We will come back to that, of course, from time to time, but we will not stay on the subject for much longer. But today the subject is not exactly who God is, although it is by saying the title of today's sermon is Who God Is Not. We're going to talk a little bit today about who God is not in the context of who God is. In Isaiah chapter 45, God says through the prophet Isaiah, and again, remember, I've said this before, I'll say it again, that this is almost always, as far as I know, it is always Christ speaking through the prophets. It is Christ interfacing with man. That does not take away the Father's prerogative to do so, but it's evident he delegated all of that to Christ, and Christ is always interacting with mankind. It is that same Christ that was called the Eternal. You alone are the Eternal in the scripture we just read in Nehemiah. In Isaiah 45, we break in at verse 5, God says, "I am the Eternal, and there is no other." Now again, some of those who got bound up in their theology in the last 20 years began to take that to mean that there could not be the Father and Christ. There could not be this two-member Godhead because there is no other. Failing to understand the point that we made last week, that the God family is just that. It is God. It is not gods. It is God. And God is made up of the Father and today the Son, who has been born as the firstborn among many brethren. So when it says, "I am the Eternal and there is no other," it is not saying, Christ is saying, "I am the Eternal and there is no Father." It is talking about the God family as God. There is no humanly devised or satanically devised alternative to who God is. And you'll see that as we go through here, what he's actually talking about. Verse 5, I am the eternal, there is no other. There is no God besides me. I will gird you, though you have not known me, that they may know from the rising of the sun to its setting that there is none besides me. Again, nothing that's said here contradicts the reality of the Godhead, of God and Christ, the eternal. There is none besides me. I am the eternal and there is no other. I form the light and create darkness. Interesting. God says, I create light, I form light and create darkness. God is the author of what you and I know as the physical universe and the light and dark that inhabit the physical universe. Now, we know that darkness and light are also used sometimes as analogies for truth and darkness, truth and sin, truth and error, right and wrong, etc. Even mankind uses it that way a great deal. And that analogy holds true. But in this case, God created light and dark. And we read about that again in Genesis 1:1. Well, we read about creating the light. But we also read that he went on, well, we didn't read, but he went on to say he set the light apart and the dark, and the darkness and the light together made a day, and so forth. So God is able to control the elements of the universe. That's the point that's being made here. God controls the elements of the universe. I form the light and create darkness, and by the same token, I make peace and create calamity. So you have to make the connection that the same God who created the heavens, the earth, the sea, and all that is in them also has the power to make peace or to create calamity if he chooses to do so. God creates calamity only to serve a positive purpose. The day of the Lord coming on this earth is going to be great calamity, but it is created to accomplish a purpose of bringing mankind to his senses and to proving that God is God, after all, and that man needs to submit himself into God's hands. So I make peace and create calamity. I, the Eternal, do all these things. So again, God is describing who he is, what he does, and he does it in terms that you and I can understand. We can understand both of those things, not that we can put ourselves in his place and make it happen. We understand light and dark. We understand the difference. And if God says, I create light and darkness, then we recognize that we can't create light and darkness. We have a certain amount of control over light and darkness, which in itself is interesting. God allows us to create electric lights. God allows us to close a door and shut the light out. God allows us to leave the door open a little bit, just a little bit ajar, so that light from some other source actually enters the room, which in itself is fascinating. You know, there are direct rays of light, but light somehow creeps around the doors. It's like air. It creeps around the door, and you can see light that may be two rooms away in the house, and your door is only open that much, but when you look up, you don't see darkness, you see some light. Because God made marvelous, wonderful things to work that way. I was scrambling eggs this morning. Now, I don't do that a lot, but I sometimes do it on Sabbath morning when Judy's making pancakes, which is sort of our traditional Sabbath morning breakfast, depending on where we are and how many miles we have to travel, but pancakes and eggs. And so about the time she gets the pancakes done, and used to be I'd break the eggs and mix the eggs and salt and pepper the eggs and all of that, and I still do when I get in there in time, but sometimes they're already sitting there in the pitcher waiting for me to pour them in the skillet. But I was scrambling eggs, and of course, you know, we happen to like our eggs done, all of us. We don't like them runny and watery and all of that. So we don't put milk in them. We just use the eggs. And when you scramble the eggs in that small skillet, obviously you get little puddles of uncooked egg on top of the rest of the egg unless you constantly stir it or turn it over or whatever. And I am not claiming to be spiritually minded at this point, but I do think it's important that we recognize that sometimes you have to learn these small lessons from small situations. I was turning the eggs, and I saw that I still didn't have them all done, and so I'm turning them over. And it just occurred to me, something that always has fascinated me since working with both plumbing and electricity many years ago, that the fact that water seeks its own level, as we say in the physics business, water seeks its own level is critical to so many things. If it weren't, we'd all be in trouble, but Just stirring the eggs made me remember, if water didn't seek its own level, if liquid didn't go to the lowest level, you couldn't even scramble eggs. You'd stir them and stir them and stir them, and there'd still be wet stuff on the top. Only the bottom would cook. And it's a simple reality, but the point is you see that and you think God made everything work. God made the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that's in them, and he made it all work. And even with Satan's disruptions and corruptions, God has still made it to work. There are a lot of things we don't know about the natural world at the time it was created. We don't know when Christ says he's going to come and restore all things. And that restoration begins that is described in Acts chapter 3. We don't know exactly how far that's going to go because we don't know what the original looked like. We can speculate on certain things. We can know that certain rules and certain laws that are according to the way God reveals himself to think are important and therefore probably are going to be part of that restoration. But there may be things happening there that we don't know have to happen because they are reversing things that were done only to counter what Satan did. Are you following me? Good. Okay. Some things that Satan has done have created circumstances in the earth that God may have had to counter by actually changing the way certain physical things worked. And yet, as far as we know, from as far as we can remember, they've always been the same. Ask Dr. Erickson or ask Mr. Norgaard. Maybe Dr. Norgaard. I didn't hear anybody call him that. Anyway, there are two or three others here with those titles. I don't have one, by the way. My title is Hey You. But ask those people who have studied these things. They depend on the law. You and I know that they depend on the law when they launch that rocket out of Cape Canaveral again. It used to be Cape Kennedy. Now it's Cape Canaveral again. And they monitor it from Houston. And they give it direction and guidance from Houston. They have to plan long time in advance where the earth is going to be in its rotation, where the moon is going to be, how all the various parts of the solar system are functioning at the time they launch that rocket, if it's going to rendezvous with the moon or even the International Space Station. They have to know a lot of things. And how do they know them? Because they always work the same way. They always work according to immutable law that God has put in place. If they didn't, you know, you'd be in really big trouble. And we talk about people flying down the road, but what if you got a little bit too fast and your car just took off and was airborne? You know, we know that's not going to happen. Now, well, it'll happen momentarily if you hit a big enough bump, but it's not going to happen. There are laws of gravity and laws of inertia and all kinds of laws that God's put in place that we just depend on and take for granted. You understand what I'm saying now when I say, let's don't take for granted that God created the heavens, the earth, the sea, and all that's in them. That's not just, a brief moment's work for any of us. It probably was only a brief moment's work in one sense for God to say the words, but God obviously had been thinking and planning and working on that for whatever time he wanted to spend on it. We can't determine that, and we can't limit God. But God says, there's nobody besides me, and I'm the same God that created light and darkness. I'm the same God that created the heavens, the earth, the sea, and all that's in them. And I'm the same God that can create peace or bring calamity. He does it all. He can do it all. But he does it all for a purpose and a reason that is commensurate with his character and his plan and his purpose. He never strays from that. The circumstances may be different because of something man does or something Satan and his demons do, and God responds to that, but the law and the purpose never change. God's character never changes. His nature never changes. He is who he is, and he is not whom he is not. No matter how many times man wants to give him labels and descriptions, he is not what he is not. And he very definitely is what he is. Verse 12, Isaiah 45, continuing, verse 12. I have made the earth and created man on it. I, my hands, stretched out the heavens, and all their host I have commanded. Commanded, set in motion, set laws to guide them and guard them and predict them. Everything is predictable. You hear scientists telling you that, oh, Halley's Comet will be back in such and such a year, and it's 100 years from now, or whatever it is. It's probably even more than that now. I can't remember. It seemed like last time was 119 years or something between the appearances of Halley's Comet. I might be off by 1,000 years or so. But anyway, the point being that it's predictable. They know when it's going to come back. God says, I commanded them. I made it the way that it is. Verse 18. For thus says the Eternal, who created the heavens, who is God, who formed the earth and made it, who has established it, who did not create it in vain, who formed it to be inhabited. That's one of the ways we know about the gap theory we talked about last week between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. God did not create the earth without form and void. He did not create the earth in tohu and bohu. He created the earth and formed it to be inhabited. I am the Eternal and there is no other. So we're back to that point. God repeats that point often in the scriptures. I am the Eternal and there is none else. Let's back up a couple of chapters to chapter 42. In chapter 42, he not only tells us who he is, but he tells us something else that's critical in our understanding. Chapter 42. Look at verse 8. I am the Eternal, that is my name, and my glory I will not give to another, nor my praise to carved images. What is God saying here? He's saying the same thing he said to Israel in the commandments. I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. I am not going to give my glory to anybody else. That is in any way different from him. Ultimately, he's going to give his glory to us even. But what God means here is in terms of glorifying some other God or glorifying some other creation of man. Or Satan himself. I am the Eternal, that is my name. My glory I will not give to another, nor my praise to carved images. I'm always amazed at how people teach or understand or don't understand certain things. And then sometimes I'm amazed at my own stupidity and ignorance. I realized some years ago how I was taught the commandments at a relatively young age, maybe 12, 13, along in there. That's when I first started going to a church. But I was taught the commandments in Sunday school or whatever. And I remember learning, you shall not make unto me any graven image. But you know that for years, even probably as a high school student, I just never made the connection or had a clue that graven was a form of the word engraved or carved or something of the sort. It just, you don't make any graven image. Well, what is a graven image? If you don't even know what graven means, or you don't know what engraved is, or you don't know what it's talking about, then you really can't keep the commandment, can you? And of course, we progressed from graven images to pictures and various kinds of forms that might not fit exactly the description engraved, but are nevertheless the same principle and the same point. Carved images, it says here. That's a pretty clear term. Will not give my glory to carved images. So God is saying, don't confuse me with anything or anybody anywhere at any time. I am God and there's no competition. I'm God and there's nobody else. Nobody else who made the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that's in them. Nobody else who made light and dark. Nobody else who can bring peace or bring calamity. I'm God. Don't confuse me with anybody else. Make the distinction. Distinguish between me and my power and my glory and anything else, and particularly a carved image. That begins to take on a certain nonsensical sound when you think of it in context of God making the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that's in them, doesn't it? Show me a carved image that's ever made anything, as God himself more or less says. Jeremiah chapter 14. Again, these prophets sent by God had to remind the nations of Israel and Judah particularly of who their God was and how they were supposed to not ignore that God, and they were supposed to understand his power and reject the idolatry that was common and the nations around them, and became common, of course, in Israel. Jeremiah chapter 14, let's look at verse 22, the last verse in the chapter. Verse 22, are there any among the idols of the nations that can cause rain? Or can the heavens give showers? See, we think of that too, don't we? People think it's just common. It's just part of the physical universe that the heavens give showers. But God had to create that law and that process by which the heavens give showers, or it wouldn't happen. Are you not he, O eternal, our God? Therefore we will wait for you, since or because you have made all these. So again, the scripture says we recognize God because of what God has done. I'm not going to go there, but remember in Romans 1, Paul said he's visible, he's known by the things that he's done. The works, the creation has made God manifest. We will wait for you because you have made all of these. God is the one who made it. God is the one who has the power to do whatever he chooses with it. But God has made it to function, to be inhabited by mankind made in his image. And God is going to preserve it until such time as it has to be dealt with in order to bring about his purpose and his plan. All right, let's go back to the history of Israel in 1 Chronicles chapter 16. 1 Chronicles chapter 16. I'm going to verse 26 for those of you writing things down. At least sooner or later we'll get to verse 26. Sometimes we start there, sometimes we end there. This is one of the elements of one of the hymns that we sing. Verse 25, for the Eternal is great and greatly to be praised. He is also to be feared above all gods. For all, and notice it says gods there, but that of course is a reference to those whom human beings call gods. He is to be feared above all gods. For all the gods of the peoples are idols. But the Eternal made the heavens. Again, there's that contrast. There's that recognition that it is the Creator God. Sometimes we come up here and we pray and we talk about the Creator God. We address him as the Creator God. We address him as our Father, our God and Creator, etc. Because the Godhead, the God family, created all that is, and he calls himself the Creator. Go back to where I was. He is the Eternal made the heavens. Honor and majesty are before him. Strength and gladness are in his place. God is the God who created all things. He is the God who is honorable and is majestic and is also full of gladness when you come to know who he is. There's a lot in this chapter about those matters. I won't take it further, but simply to say that it clearly enunciates that all the gods of the peoples are idols. Doesn't matter what kind of gods those are. Doesn't matter whether it's the sun or the moon or some other part of the universe that people worship or call gods. Doesn't matter whether it is idols in the sense of those things that you commit your life to, because remember, God says through the Apostle Paul in Romans chapter 6 that whatever you yield yourself a servant to obey, his servant you are. So you can make gods out of anything you allow yourself to serve. It could be family, it could be friends, it could be bosses, it could be cigarettes, it could be crack, it could be whatever. Whatever you yield yourself servants to obey, his servants you are, therefore he is your God. He or it or some philosophy, some concept, whatever it may be. Satan has succeeded, and this is off the subject, and I won't go very far here, but Satan has succeeded in corrupting man's mind to the point where he thinks that certain concepts are so valuable that they are to be protected and defended and worshipped. And mankind falls into that trap and accepts it and says, oh yes, we have to do this. Maybe fairness would be one of those just off the top of my head. Fairness. Everything has to be fair. Okay. So in the name of fairness, you can change all kinds of realities in order to make things fair. And yet, you don't find that kind of fairness as a part of the character of God. You find truth and fairness in the sense of justice and righteousness in God's character, but that does not make everybody else or everything else have to be equal in order to be fair. Christ is the one, if I remember, who said, take from him that has not and give to him that has. Whoa, so much for fairness. Take from him that has not and give to him that has. It's not man's way. All the gods of the people are idols. And we can worship idols and serve idols that are concepts and ideas and things that we were taught as children that are not really valid, but they're part of who we are, and they're part of our vanity, they're part of our standards, and so they're almost like gods. I will not compromise with my position. My dad was a fine man. He raised 10 children pretty much without the health to carry on a job, put us through school, etc. But he had certain things in his conscience. Didn't matter how much of a sinner he was, and he was. In fact, he tried to be baptized 2 or 3 times, but he continually tried to convince the ministry that he was worthy of baptism, that he was good enough to be baptized. And he never got the picture when they told him what the problem was. He never understood that they were telling him he was too righteous to be baptized. But he had certain things in his psyche, certain things in his form of honor that you could not compromise with. You could not get him to compromise with. Didn't matter how reasonable or unreasonable they were, he would not compromise with his value and their strength and character in that on one level. But if it's the wrong value, if it's a wrong concept, if it's a misunderstanding, such as some people would keep a certain day of the week, for example, or some people would eat or not eat a certain food, those things can become so ingrained in their minds that they will never even look at the truth, because the truth has to agree with them. I hope you understand what I'm saying. Those things are idols. They are things that we hold to and cling to and worship. My dad's personal honor was of extreme importance to him. But that honor had a value system that didn't necessarily hold true in every situation. Therefore, his honor could be honorable about something that he was wrong about or that was contrary to God's will, but he was honorable about it. And of course, if you've seen any mafia movies at all, you know that's a fairly common human trait among certain people. You got to have honor in the things that you believe in, regardless of how many other things you don't believe in or can't even begin to function with. You can kill everybody not in the family, but don't do anything to anybody in the family. Unless, of course, they contradict your honor or deceive the family, and then you can blot them out too. You have this set of criteria by which you live that can become idols. Most of us aren't in that business, but you can create idols out of thin air in that sense. And God says all the gods of the people are idols. So it's not just the carved images, but in those days, carved images were a huge problem. They still are today. God had some things to say back again in the book of Jeremiah chapter 10, beginning in verse 5. God had some things to say about those carved images too. If you tried to do a study or a sermon or whatever on this subject and looked at all of the scriptures and all the descriptions that God gives you of his attitude toward idols and his attitude toward carved images, it would take a very long time. Jeremiah chapter 10, some of you will say, I know that chapter, that's the Christmas tree chapter. And indeed it is, but of course it's far bigger than just the Christmas tree. We use the application for a Christmas tree, and Mr. Armstrong very effectively helped a lot of people understand that they were following idols by describing Jeremiah chapter 10's discussion as a Christmas tree. It certainly applies to the Christmas tree, don't misunderstand me, but it applies to other idols and so forth. The Christmas tree is one prime example in our society of how people do what God is saying here, but it is not the only example. But notice the process. I probably should back up a bit to verse 3, Jeremiah 10 verse 3. For the customs of the peoples are futile, or vain in the King James. For one cuts a tree from the forest, the work of the hands of the workman with the axe. They decorate it with silver and gold. They fasten it with nails and hammers so that it will not topple. Yeah, I remember that very action in the Christmas tree world. They didn't keep Christmas very long at my house. My mother quit keeping Christmas when I was about 12. I very well remember our last Christmas tree, which my older brothers and I went out and dragged in from the woods, much to my mother's chagrin. But my dad allowed it because he had not decided it was worth quitting keeping Christmas. And, of course, we couldn't go out and buy these fancy stands that you put Christmas trees in today with the metal and the ring and all of that. No, you made it out of 2x4s and hoped you could get it so it didn't fall over. And depending on the size of the tree and the size of the room, that was kind of difficult to do. But this applies exactly to that scenario. But God is also talking about totem poles, if you will, or various kinds of idols that were carved out of a tree and that had silver and gold beat on them so that they had an image, perhaps a face. And you see those described in the various scriptures relating to Israel's idolatry. One cuts a tree, okay, he decorates it, verse 4. They fasten it so it doesn't go. Verse 5, they are upright like a palm tree, and they cannot speak. You start to see God ridiculing here, a little bit of humor, derision, if you will. They are upright like a palm tree, and they cannot speak. They must be carried because they cannot go by themselves. You know, God is making fun of these idols. Do we understand that? Do we get that point? God is making fun of these idols. You set them up, you call them God, and they can't even move. Do not be afraid of them, for they cannot do evil, nor can they do any good. They can't do anything. They're the product of human beings' creativity and idolatry that puts them in an important position, and they don't mean anything. I find it interesting how certain conservatives in our society will, again, defend to the death the right of people to have Christmas trees on the public square or in the local high school or whatever, because they see it as a question of freedom of religion, of freedom of expression or whatever. And so they're defending a conservative position of freedom from government intrusion, but in so doing they choose something that is freedom from God's instruction and God's commandments. And they rally around, the last couple of years it's actually been the term, Merry Christmas, right? Have you followed that? And they get into the situation where people wanted to be politically correct, and so everybody said Happy Holidays. Because it might be Christmas, it might be, you might be talking to a Jewish person or a Muslim or whomever, so you can't say Merry Christmas, so you said Happy Holidays. And so the conservative talk hosts and so forth jumped on the bandwagon to defend the right of commercial enterprises, stores and so forth, to say Merry Christmas to their customers. I mean, we get bent out of shape over things that are really completely irrelevant, but they are to us very, very important. So the right to say Merry Christmas itself becomes an idol. When Christmas itself is an idol, and the Christmas tree is an idol. But the right to have it is a freedom that rises above the value of any of it. And in that sense, there is truth in that. That does rise above what the value is of Christmas, but it becomes an idol in itself. They cannot do evil, they cannot do good. Inasmuch as there is none like you, O Eternal, you are great, and your name is great in might. Who would not fear you, O King of the nations? For this is your rightful due. For among all the wise men of the nations, and in all their kingdoms, there is none like you. But they are altogether dull-hearted and foolish. A wooden idol is worthless doctrine. That's what it is. It's worthless doctrine. Silver is beaten into plates. It is brought from Tarshish, and gold from Uphaz, the work of the craftsman in the hands of the metalsmith. Blue and purple are their clothing. They are the work of skillful men. So they have all of these elaborate, ostentatious presentations, but they are all of no value. They're all the work of skillful men. Verse 10, but the Eternal is the true God. He is the living God and the everlasting King. At his wrath, the earth will tremble, and the nations will not be able to endure his indignation. So God is the one you have to be concerned about. It is not the carved images, or the silver and gold, or the trees that are nailed down so they cannot go anywhere because they can't do anything. They can't say anything. They can't accomplish anything. They can't carry themselves. They have to be carried around. Habakkuk chapter 2, or some of you will call it Habakkuk, and I don't know what the right pronunciation is. Just find it, would you? That's hard enough. It's back here somewhere hiding between these books. Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 18. Here's the question from God. What profit is it? What profit is the image that its maker should carve it? Why go to the trouble of carving an image? What profit is the image that its maker should carve it? The molded image, a teacher of lies. Whoa. Now, even though it can't say anything and it can't carry itself, it's a teacher of lies. Isn't that interesting? A teacher of lies that the maker of its mold should trust in it to make mute idols. Woe to him who says to wood, awake, or to silent stone, arise, it shall teach. Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, yet in it there is no breath at all. But the Eternal is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. So over and over and over again, God derides man's creation of carved images and other kinds of idols that he looks to for guidance, prays to, seeks help from, or whatever, when it cannot function, it has no breath, it doesn't awake, it doesn't do anything. It's a product of man's own skillful hands. God says that's kind of funny on the one level, tragic on the other, because it teaches lies, as he said here. The very existence of it teaches lies. But God derides it, makes fun of it, at the same time telling us it's a very serious matter. Now, my next scripture is especially interesting. It's especially interesting because it says kings. And I don't remember off the top of my head whether it's first or second, and I can't tell for the context, so I'm going to have to go look. Now, if you want to start writing your notes, just leave a blank and write down Kings 17:15, and I'll tell you which kings we're talking about in a minute. 2 Kings, 2 Kings chapter 17, verse 15. I don't know how I left that out. 2 Kings chapter 17, verse 15. God is describing here the way Israel conducted itself, and this is a chapter about them being carried away captive to Assyria. And if we pick it up in verse 14, it says, "Nevertheless, they would not hear, but stiffened their necks, like the necks of their fathers who did not believe in the Eternal their God." See, they didn't believe in God. They didn't believe in the Creator God. "And they rejected his statutes and his covenant that he had made with their fathers and his testimonies which he had testified against them. They followed idols, became idolaters, and went after the nations who were all around them." So Israel had God. They were related to God. They were called out and attached to God. They were married to Christ, as you and I are today. But they deserted Christ and went after the idols of the nations all around them, concerning whom the Eternal had charged them that they should not do like them. So they left all the commandments of the Eternal their God, made for themselves a molded image and two calves, made a wooden image, and worshipped all the host of heaven and served Baal. So on and on it goes. He talks about passing their children through the fire and so forth. And verse 18 says, "Therefore the Eternal was very angry with Israel and removed them from his sight. There was none left but the tribe of Judah only." So God actually had to send Israel into captivity because of that idolatry, Sabbath breaking and other things. But rejecting God and turning to idols, they knew God and they turned away from God. Now, they only knew God on a physical level, please understand. They were not called, they were not given spiritual salvation or that offer for spiritual salvation. They were given an offer of a long and prosperous life and a protected nation and every kind of blessing physically you could imagine. They were given everything. and they rejected it for dumb idols, the kind of idols that we've just been reading about, as he says here, carved images, golden calves, wooden images, the host of heaven, all the different planets and stars and so forth, and Baal. And God rightly, of course, was angry with them. Back to Hosea chapter 4. Hosea chapter 4, verse 12. I always find that the easiest way to find Hosea is go to Daniel and then just keep turning pages until you get to Hosea. Hosea chapter 4, verse 12. My people ask counsel from their wooden idols, and their staff informs them. So here you are. You're walking along in the mountains, hiking along with your staff, and you stop and you say, which way shall I go? You know, do I turn left at this corner, or do I turn right? What do I do? And your staff is supposed to tell you? God is saying, they seek counsel from their idols. Their staff informs them. Now, I've had my staff inform me several times, but it wasn't that wooden staff. It was a bunch of people who thought they knew more than I did, and they usually did. Their staff informs them, for the spirit of harlotry has caused them to stray. They have played the harlot against their God. See, they were married to God, and they turned away from God and sought idols. They offer sacrifices on the mountaintops and burn incense on the hills, under oaks, poplars, and terebinths, because their shade is good. Because their shade is good. Therefore, your daughters commit harlotry and your brides commit adultery, etc. God says, you seek counsel from your idols, and your idols can't help you. Your staff can't give you the answer you need when it's a wooden staff that you're walking on. But Israel played the harlot in that sense because they turned away from God. Hosea chapter 8, let's go back just three or four pages. Hosea 8, verse 1. Here's the condemnation in that sense, or the prophecy against Israel and their rejection of God. Hosea 8, chapter 8, verse 1. Set the trumpet to your mouth. He shall come like an eagle against the house of the Eternal, because they have transgressed my covenant. When he says he's talking about God's instrument, another nation he's going to send against them. He shall come like an eagle against the house of the Eternal, because they have transgressed my covenant and rebelled against my law. Israel will cry to me, my God, we know you. Israel has rejected the good. The enemy will pursue him. They set up kings, but not by me. They made princes, but I did not acknowledge them. From their silver and gold, they made idols for themselves, that they might be cut off. Get the connection. He says they made idols for themselves, theoretically to save them, and yet the making of those idols is what cut them off from God. They made idols for themselves that they might be cut off. Your calf is rejected, O Samaria. My anger is aroused against them. How long will they attain to innocence? Far from Israel is even this. A workman made it, and it is not God. A workman made it. And again, it could be a carved image. It could be a theory. It could be a personal preference. It could be a compromise between you and the truth of God and the law of God that you know. A workman made it, and it is not God. But the calf of Samaria shall be broken to pieces. They sow the wind and reap the whirlwind. The stalk has no bud. It shall never produce meal. If it should produce, aliens would swallow it up. So God says, it's not going to take you anywhere. You're not going to have any positive blessing as a result of this kind of lifestyle. It's idolatry. It's contrary to God. And God is the God who created you. God is the God who created the heavens, the earth, the sea, and all that's in them. We don't want to forget that. And he created man in his image and said, serve me. Ezekiel, we haven't dealt with the prophet. Ezekiel chapter 14, verse 1. Ezekiel 14. Notice that God not only defines idolatry as contrary to his truth, but he takes a very dim view of it and then pronounces potential consequences, punishments, evil to come upon those people who serve idols. So it isn't something God takes lightly. When we talk about who is God, we also have to know who is God not, which is what we're talking about today, because otherwise we might slip into believing that we're somehow serving God through whatever idol it is we have chosen. Chapter 14, verse 1, Ezekiel. Now some of the elders of Israel came to me and sat before me, and the word of the Eternal came to me, saying, Son of man, these men have set up their idols in their hearts. Whoa. There's a new version. They have set up their idols in their hearts and put before them that which causes them to stumble into iniquity. So you see, it can be their own thinking. It can be their own rationale, their own reasoning, their own human perceptions of things. Should I let myself be inquired of at all by them? God says they've already decided who their God is. Why should I listen to them and answer them? Therefore speak to them and say to them, Thus says the Eternal God, every one of the house of Israel who sets up his idols in his heart and puts before him what causes him to stumble into iniquity and then comes to the prophet, I, the Eternal, will answer him who comes according to the multitude of his idols. And God says, I'm going to deal with you according to your own sins, which is what he says otherwise. That I may seize the house of Israel by their heart because they are all estranged from me by their idols. Therefore, say to the house of Israel, Thus says the Eternal God, Repent, turn away from your idols, and turn your faces away from your abominations. So God's interest is not in the punishment. God's interest is not in the tragedy or the calamity that he said he can bring. God's interest is in the repentance and the restoration and the return to God. God would want Israel to turn. He said to them, Why will you die, O Israel? He said to them, I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked. So God, in a sense, is appealing to them even while he is condemning their actions. Isaiah chapter 2. Isaiah 2. Verse 1, the word that Isaiah the son of Amos saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. Now it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Eternal's house shall be established on the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow to it. God is interested in restoration. He's interested in repentance. He's interested in salvation. He's interested in saving the people from ultimate death. Many people shall come and say, Come and let us go up to the mountain of the Eternal. Now God just finished saying, if you ask me, I'm going to give you advice according to your idols. But now he's saying, in a prophecy of the time to come when Christ is ruling, people will come, in this case with a right humble attitude, and say, Let's go up to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Eternal from Jerusalem. He shall judge between the nations and rebuke many people and shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. This is not just a subject for the Feast of Tabernacles, brethren. This is the hope of mankind. This is what God is doing and what Christ is waiting for. The word of the Eternal will go forth from Jerusalem. He'll judge between the nations, rebuke many people. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. God's going to take away the idolatry. He's going to take away the blindness. He's going to strip it away from them. He's going to give mankind an opportunity to see. Now, Israel will have to be punished before that occurs. And actually, he gives that description a little bit here, just going on. Verse 6. For you have forsaken your people, the house of Jacob, because they are filled with eastern ways. They are soothsayers like the Philistines, and they are pleased with the children of foreigners. Their land is also full of silver and gold, and there is no end to their treasures. Their land is also full of horses, and there is no end to their chariots. Their land is also full of idols. They worship the work of their own hands. Verse 12 says, For the day of the Eternal of hosts shall come upon everything proud and lofty, upon everything lifted up, and it shall be brought low. So they're going to be brought low before they come asking for God's guidance and God's instruction. Verse 18, he gives them counsel, But the idols he shall utterly abolish. They shall go into the holes of the rocks and into the caves of the earth. You read that in Revelation, remember? From the terror of the eternal and the glory of his majesty when he arises to shake the earth mightily. In that day a man will cast away his idols of silver and of gold, which they made each for himself to worship, to the moles and the bats, to go into the clefts of the rocks and into the crags and the rugged rocks. From the terror of the eternal and the glory of his majesty when he arises to shake the earth mightily. Sever yourselves from such a man whose breath is in his nostrils, for of what account is he? You know, God is going to take charge of all of it, and God is going to bring it to repentance. And for those who repent, there is going to be a beautiful time of joy and happiness at the law of God and the truth of God flowing out of Jerusalem. In Isaiah chapter 40, he gives us that a brief vision of his strong hand intervening in the end of the age. Isaiah chapter 40, it happened to Israel in the form of captivity. It will happen to the whole world in the day of the Lord. Isaiah chapter 40, verse 10. Behold, the eternal God shall come with a strong hand, and his arm shall rule for him. Behold, his reward is with him, and his work before him. He will feed his flock like a shepherd. He will gather the lambs with his arm and carry them in his bosom and gently lead those who are with young. That's God's desire. That's what Christ is coming for, to bind up and to heal and to feed and clothe and encourage those who are destitute. Verse 12, who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand. We talked about that earlier. The sea and all that's in them. God can measure that in the hollow of his hand. He measured heaven with a span and calculated the dust of the earth in a measure. Again, giving us just a little inkling that we don't have a clue how great God is and what he's able to do with the physical elements that we take for granted. The water and the heavens and the dust. He weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance. God is fantastic and wonderful and mighty. He is not an idol. He is not a carved image. Verse 15, behold, the nations are as a drop in the bucket and are counted as the small dust on the scales. You know, in the old days, they used balances, put equal balances on each side of the scale to weigh something before you charge somebody for it. So you put the meat on this side and you put the weight on that side. And you were supposed to clean the dust off of the scales instead of putting your finger on it, pushing it down a little bit while you were weighing it. You're supposed to clean the dust off of it so that it was a pure weight. And God says, even if there's a little dust on there, you look at it and you think, well, that's not a big deal. I don't feel like I got overcharged just because he didn't dust the scales, right? But God says the nations are like the small dust on the scales. In other words, they're pretty negligible. They're irrelevant. They don't even count. Coming down to verse 18, to whom then will you liken God, or what likeness will you compare to him? The workman molds an image, the goldsmith overspreads it with gold, and the silversmith casts silver chains. Whoever is too impoverished for such a contribution chooses a tree that will not rot. So you don't have silver and gold, let's just do it out of wood. He seeks for himself a skillful workman to prepare a carved image that will not totter. Have you not known? Have you not heard? Has it not been told to you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them out like a tent to dwell in. He brings the princes to nothing. He makes the judges of the earth useless. Scarcely shall they be planted. Scarcely shall they be sown. Scarcely shall their stock take root in the earth. When he will also blow on them and they will wither and the whirlwind will take them away like stubble. God is saying it doesn't matter who man is or how great he is or what he's done. He's nothing in God's eyes. To whom then will you liken me, or to whom shall I be equal, says the Holy One. Lift up your eyes on high and see who has created these things, who brings out their host by number, the stars that you and I can't begin to count, even the ones that we can see, not to mention the ones that we can't see. He calls them all by name, by the greatness of his might and the strength of his power. Not one is missing. Why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, my way is hidden from the eternal? God doesn't know what I'm doing. God doesn't see me. God doesn't really relate to me. God's way off somewhere. Israel and Judah, you're acting foolish. Why do you say, my way is hidden from the eternal, and my just claim is passed over by my God. He's not fair. He's not fair. My just claim is passed over. Have you not known? Have you not heard? The everlasting God, the eternal, the creator of the ends of the earth, neither faints nor is weary. His understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the weak, and to those who have no might, he increases strength. Yes, the weak of the world are called to confound the mighty, to become the very children of God. Even the youths shall faint and be weary, and young men shall utterly fall. But those who wait on the Eternal shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. Those who follow idols blow away. Those who follow God run or walk or do whatever it is that God gives them to do, and God supports them so that they mount up like the wings of an eagle. God's way is good. God is all-powerful. Idols are nothing. We can create our idols. They can be carved images. They can be Christmas trees. They can be false concepts and ideas and theories that we cling to. And all of them are nothing in God's eyes. They're less than the small dust of the balance. And God is going to bring them to naught. And God is going to bring his kingdom and his law to the fore. And he's going to bring man to finally success and salvation in his presence as spirit-born family members of the family of God for eternity.